Okay. So I'll be talking about the universality of long-distance ADS physics from the CFT bootstrap. So what I'll be discussing from the point of view of field theory are some very, very general theorems derived from the CFT bootstrap. But everyone has their own motivation. These theorems are maybe interesting for many reasons. One of my main motivations and the thing that I'm most excited about these theorems is their relationship and implication for the universality of long-distance physics in ADS. So a lot of the talk, I will be reviewing properties of ADS, but you should know that everything that I'm saying is derivable just directly from the CFT bootstrap without any reference to ADS at all. So, and I should say the history of the subject, there's a perturbative proof of some of what I'll talk about due to Callan and Gross from a very long time ago. There is a paper by Alday and Maldacena, which is very nice, about comments on large spin operators, which is probably the first general version of what we're talking about. There's a paper from the end of 2012 by these people and myself and by Sasha and Zohar simultaneously about the story in for CFTs in three or more dimensions. And then there's this upcoming work which reviews that and extends, interestingly, to CFT2 and with implications for ADS3. So the idea, to make it sound as trivial as possible via an analogy to scattering, is the following. Imagine we have some simple tree-level process in a scattering amplitude with a T-channel exchange. So we have, say, particle 1 and 2 go to 3 and 4. Then, if we have a massless T-channel exchange, we'll have some behavior that looks like 1 over 1 minus cosine theta as a function of the scattering angle. Now, a question one can ask is, how is this reproduced in terms of partial waves for scattering? So in general, there will be some partial wave amplitude that I can write, schematically as some function of the center of mass energy times some Legendre or Gegenbauer polynomials in cosine theta. And there's an extremely trivial point that can be made here, which is that here there's this T-channel singularity as cosine theta approaches 1. So the left-hand side blows up. But when cosine theta approaches 1 on the right-hand side, nothing special happens in any single partial wave for the scattering amplitude. So the only way this singularity can be reproduced is by some large angular momentum partial wave behavior.
But they are conjugated. So small theta is conjugated to large L.
Good. Then you already knew the answer. So, yes, indeed, this forward scattering, if you want to think about it that way, small theta is related to large L. So, essentially, the point of this talk will be to generalize this idea to conformal field theory in various contexts, where one can think about the scattering amplitude as, in principle, some process happening in an ADS spacetime instead of flat spacetime, and where the statement concerning these partial waves becomes a statement about conformal partial waves or conformal blocks. And one other point that I can emphasize about this that we also usually wouldn't make a fuss about is that this is really some statement about two particle states. We're used to the fact that in scattering theory, once you're talking about particles, you know that there are two particle states where the two particles are very, very well separated. This theta goes to zero limit is just the limit of forward scattering where the particles don't really talk to each other at all. So the existence of these large L partial waves can be viewed as a statement about the existence of certain two particle states at large angular momentum. In fact, if you were to put this scattering system into a box, you'd have some discretum of states and you'd exactly have some two-particle large angular momentum states. That's interesting, as it will turn out, as a statement about the CFT bootstrap, because
large momentum particle state exists even for free particles.
Exactly.
Right. So, but singularity exists only when interaction is there. Right?
Good. Good. So there's an even more singular piece that I didn't write down because it would be annoying to regulate, which is the forward scattering amplitude where the particles don't talk to each other at all. Mm-hmm. That will actually be the focus. That free propagation piece will actually be the focus when we talk about CFTs. And this will be a correction from which we extract anomalous dimensions. So that's a good point. But anyway, I'm just emphasizing the fact that the existence of these partial waves in the case of CFT will be a statement about the spectrum of the CFT, which by itself is non-trivial. So as an outline, basically the talk will have two halves. I'll have the first half where I'll talk about ADS, you call it ADS expectations. And basically, this will be a review. I'll try to make it streamlined, especially since I talked about a lot of this in brief at the conference. I don't want to bore you. I don't want to confuse you either. And so I'll review what I mean by long-distance physics and ADS in CFT terms. I'll talk about what I mean by cluster decomposition, the fact that in ADS, two systems don't talk to each other if they're very far apart. I'll talk about anomalous dimensions at large spin. And then I'll talk about what happens when we include gravitational interactions, in particular, the anomalous dimensions that come about when you have some object orbiting a massive state that produces a long-range gravitational field. And then finally, I'll review ADS3 expectations. At least to me, I didn't know some of that story until working on this project. In particular, there are deficit angles in ADS3 due to massive sources if they're below the BTZ mass. And then there are BTZ black holes above the Planck scale. And at least a fact that surprised me initially is that there are no stable orbits around BTZ black holes. And that will be important in what we discover for the CFT.
I wonder, in this kind of approach you presented, let's say you can see the theory where there's no massless particle. So there is no massless exchanges, okay? Free particle large momenta still exists, right? But there is no singularity of this type, right? No, in the sense that you are talking about CFT theories, still you can discuss also kind of massive theories as well, right? And there.
So I think I can answer what you're going to say in the following way. When I'm translating all this in the CFT, it'll be a statement about operators and dimensions. There's a universal operator present in any CFT team you knew. That translates into what you would call the graviton if there's an ADS description. And so in some sense, in any CFT, there's always some massless thing that you can exchange.
No, of course. Of course, CFT, by definition, contains long range. I agree. But when you are saying that it is just you start from non-interactive particles, this does exist even without long range. You have short-range theory, right?
So there's a special kind of CFT that corresponds to a free quantum field theory in ADS that I'll refer to as a generalized free theory, and that's certainly an example of that. And then there are no anomalous dimensions at all. Uh-huh. All correlators are determined by two-point functions, and that's a perfectly fine example. So just to finish mentioning what I'm saying about the outline, in the second half, I will then derive all of these ADS expectations from the CFT. And so if you want to fall asleep for half of the talk, you can listen to the ADS expectations part and know that I'm going to prove that all those statements are true in the second half. But that's what I'll be doing. So this will involve the bootstrap. This is just some expectations from ADS. So I'll often talk about objects in ADS. So by an object, in ADS, I mean something extremely general. I just mean a CFT primary O with definite, say, twist and angular momentum. And when that operator acts on the vacuum, it creates what I'll call an object in ADS. Now, of course, we can specialize to theories where we have specific particle states in ADS, but the reason why I'm able to be so general is that the fact that I have a primary and its descendants allows me to define the center of mass motions and the center of mass wave function. So this is the center of mass psi, directly as corresponding to particular descendant states in the CFT. So qualitatively, the idea is that the primary state is defined by the fact that it's annihilated by all of the special conformal generators. The conformal group in the CFT is the isometry group in ADS. So the wave functions for the primary state and the descendant states are determined entirely by the realization of the conformal generators as isometry, as differential operators that generate the isometries in ADS. So in particular, for a primary, for example, the fact that k mu psi 0, 0 has to vanish, because primaries are annihilated by all d of the special conformal generators, implies that the center of mass wave function for a primary state is just of this form, where delta is the dimension of the primary. And I should probably tell you, just for completeness, that when I wrote that down, I'm thinking of the metric in these global coordinates. So the point I'm making is that for any primary, I can think of it as having a unique center of mass wave function in ADS, and I don't need to assume anything about there actually being some physical ADS theory. But now, what I'd really like to do for this, for the purposes of the talk, is to talk about two objects in ADS. So how can I do that? Well, I want two very well separated objects. And in a general CFT, it's certainly not obvious that there exists such a state in ADS. In fact, that's one of the things that we'll prove. But if, and I just for now just say if, there's a weak bulk coupling, then there exist primaries that I'll call, say, O1, O2, N sub L, which you can think of as being like double trace operators, O1, you can think of as being double trace primary operators, which correspond in this picture of the ADS cylinder of having two objects moving around at some distance from each other. And the crucial point that I want to make is that the geodesic separation kappa between these two objects is given by RADS times the log of L squared over delta 1, delta 2. So what does this say? It says something fairly intuitive. If you take two objects and you spin them around each other at very, very large angular momentum, then they'll be well separated. The reason why they don't fly apart is that we're in ADS, so there is an effectively an ADS potential that keep them close together. So unlike in flat space, this is just some state that lives in some finite region. It doesn't just fly apart. But the separation is given by this formula. So what this means is that if in the CFT we can study the properties of and prove the existence of operators at large spin, we're really studying states that look like objects moving around in ADS.
That formula is true for order one delta? Or is it some limit?
This is definitely true in the semi-classical limit. It might be modified at order one delta. I don't remember for sure. It's not, the log certainly isn't modified, but the order one factors might be. And in particular, it's interesting to study the dimension of these primaries, which in the presence of a weak coupling, take this form. So in the example of just a completely free theory in ADS, these two object operators or double trace operators if in some large n expansion would just have a dimension given by delta 1 plus delta 2 plus integers representing the kinematic motion. But due to interactions in ADS, there will be some anomalous dimension gamma nl.
And L is L of, they have the same L or what?
So this is the L corresponding to the angular momentum of this state. So these.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So the interesting feature of this anomalous dimension is that since it's a function of L, looking at its behavior at large L tells us about the interaction energy between these two objects in ADS at large distances, just given by this formula. So in particular, if we can show that gamma goes to zero at large L, then we know that we have what looks like approximately free non-interacting objects at large distances. Okay.
Why does the number enter into the separation?
So this is a formula at, you're completely right, at large L. Small n. So what does the n quantum number correspond to? It corresponds to some breathing mode, or in some, if you construct some semi-classical wave packet, it corresponds to something like the eccentricity of the orbit. You can have perfectly circular orbits at n equals zero, or you can have elliptical orbits with large n and large l, and here I'm ignoring
but,
n.
But let's say that we are like indeed some correlate, okay? Those two, or one or two, and then let's say that's connected by massless particle. I mean, in between, then it would be just kind of geometrical progression when you expand in the mu, right? I mean, up to some factors would be geometrical progression, right? Which shows that it is kind of distance to singularity similar to what you said about, say, small theta. So this L would be conjugated to this massless singularity, and I wonder that this would be there, but in this approximation, I even not thinking about gamma. If I have this exchange.
Well, let me just tell you, maybe I can just answer your question simply. So gamma and L, due to the exchange of a state in ADS with twist tau, will fall off with some constant over L to the twist. As L goes to infinity. This also corresponds via this formula to some constant times e to the minus twist kappa. This is the fact that all interactions in ADS shut off exponentially. So even, say, the massless graviton has an interaction that very large distances shuts off exponentially. So that's I think, how you should be thinking about this. And in fact, from the bootstrap, we'll derive things like this.
Does gamma always negative? Let me just to be sure that I follow. If I take two scalar fields in ADS with dimension delta 1, delta 2,
yes.
And some, let's say, 5 to the 4th interaction, I calculate the boundary okay? And you pass away by analysis, then you get this. Right?
Precisely. So in the case that you just mentioned, gamma will be zero at large L because a phi to the fourth interaction only has an L equals zero partial wave. Mm-hmm. But precisely, you'll compute this. There are many examples from the literature.
The divergence of the series would be still there. If you're summing over L, it would be still divergent at large L, right?
So it depends. In the Euclidean region, it's convergent. Okay. There's a light cone.
Right, but convergent in the sense that it would be...
It reproduces some singularity.
Yeah.
So a final point I just want to emphasize is that the existence of these operators in a general CFT is already non-trivial. They definitely exist if there's some weak bulk coupling. They also exist in a weakly coupled CFT description with a weak field theory coupling. But it's not at all obvious why they exist. And certainly in something like the 3D icing model, I think it's at least somewhat surprising that these exist in the OPE. So where do you find these? They're in the OPE of O1 and O2. And the existence of these operators in a completely general CFT, combined with the fact that this gamma, so gamma and L goes to 0 as L goes to infinity, is what I will interpret as cluster decomposition in ADS. So if that's unclear, you should ask me. So further, how do we compute this gamma? Well, I'll give you an example where we compute it in this upcoming paper. So if I have some situation, now I'll just draw ADS, time is coming out of the cylinder, time is coming out of the board. If I have some heavy state here and some light state orbiting it, at large distances, I can compute this gamma due to the gravitational interaction. And in fact, there's a simple perturbative calculation that allows me to do this. So the metric due to this heavy guy of mass m is just the well-known ADS Schwarzschild metric. Where this function u is 1 minus mu over r to the d minus 2. And mu is related to the black hole mass by 16 pi g. So it doesn't have to be a black hole. It could just be some finite mass particle, but it could also be a black hole. So this mu parameter is related in this way. And the point is that at large r, at least for, so we're specializing to d greater than or equal to 3 for now. At large r, this metric is just becoming the ADS metric. And in particular, this effect is very, very small. This deviation from ADS is very small. So it's possible to compute using first order perturbation theory. We don't need Feynman diagrams or anything particularly fancy. We can just evaluate gamma and L via some psi. So this is some light particle with wave function psi that's orbiting around. We can just evaluate gamma and L, these anomalous dimensions, by computing the expectation value. In fact, we don't even need quantum mechanics. We should be able to do this classically as well, by evaluating the expectation value of the Hamiltonian as it's perturbed by this term in the presence of the unperturbed wave function for psi in pure ADS. The idea is that if this is very, very far away, the wave functions are almost the same, and this is the standard first-order perturbation theory result. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but one can definitely do the calculation, and we'll see, or at least I'll claim that it matches the bootstrap. So I'll just write down what the answer looks like. So I should say this is in the limit that delta 1 and delta 2 are much bigger than 1. So this is in the semi-classical limit where these guys are both heavy compared to the ADS scale. But yeah, one can just compute this, and you see this characteristic 1 over L to the D minus 2 behavior, which is indicative of that exponential fall off of the gravitational field with geodesic distance. So this is something that, even including numerical factors, will match to some bootstrap calculation. Okay. So what about ADS3? So ADS3 is rather different. So as is well known, at least in flat space, gravity has no propagating degrees of freedom in three dimensions, but it's still non-trivial. And in particular, solving Einstein's equations around a massive source gives you a deficit angle. So I'm writing down the metric in ADS3 in the presence of some source of mass m at the origin. And I'm writing it in a slightly funny way. I could possibly write it in a simpler way. So what does this represent? It represents, again, in this kind of picture, there's some heavy source. And although the metric is pure ADS everywhere, there is an angle cut out. And this angle is 2 pi 1 minus the square root of 1 minus 8 gm. So I've written the metric in this slightly funny way because in these coordinates, T and theta are radial quantization coordinates as I approach the boundary. But you could also imagine rewriting this in a simpler way where I multiply through here and redefine T. And then the only effect here is that 1 minus 8 gm multiplies d theta squared. And so it's obvious that there's a deficit angle. So I emphasize that in these coordinates, theta really lives in that interval. And so this is ADS3 with the deficit angle. So one would like to repeat the same kind of analysis. What's the effect on a light particle that's orbiting around this heavy source? And one can do that by just solving for the modes of a scalar field in this background. But in fact, that's already basically been done for us once we've solved the problem in ADS3, because this metric is everywhere ADS with only this deficit angle. And so I should say in pure ADS, the energy levels are just what we talked about before, maybe delta plus 2n plus L for some object orbiting with dimension delta. And all we need to do to get the deficit angle energies is rescale delta to delta root 1 minus 8 gm, and n goes to. And the solutions for a scalar field in pure ADS become solutions in this deficit angle metric via that rescaling. And so we see that the energy levels now take the form delta plus 2n. So there are a couple of features of this that are important. The main one being that this is a change in the energy of all of these states, which does not vanish as L goes to infinity. So that's a reflection of the fact that you can measure the existence of a deficit angle at arbitrarily large distances from the source creating that deficit angle. So this is a hint of why the story in two-dimensional conformal field theory is very different from the story in higher dimensions. It's because although these large L states exist, they have anomalous dimensions which never go away. And in particular, you can expand this. So you can write this as some gamma n L in the limit that delta 1 and delta 2 are much less than C, much bigger than 1. You can expand this and write this as an anomalous dimension that takes that form. So this is some anomalous dimension that's independent of L. And it's not totally surprising if we are just cavalier and take the limit that D equals 2, we see that we would have gotten
you're relating C to G,
are you? Yeah, so C is related to, So it's something like 2 over 3G. Or did I flip that? So yeah, that's all I'm doing. So, so now there's a final case of the BTZ black hole. And its metric is just an analytic continuation of that metric past the threshold where this quantity vanishes. But I'll rewrite it in a slightly different way. So this is the BTZ metric. When R plus is 0, that corresponds to 8GM equals 1. And so there's a, there's a more general BTZ metric with spin, but for simplicity, I'm just sticking with this. So a surprise for me, at least, maybe not for you, is that there are no orbits. No stable classical orbits in this background. And probably the simplest way to see this is that one can study geodesics, and one can study them in terms of some radial equation, which I'll write for both BTZ and the ADS Schwarzschild at once. This is for a massive particle, so it's a time-like geodesic. So the point of interest, basically, is that V of R in the case of BTZ, so in the case of BTZ, BTZ is D equals 2. In the case of BTZ, this is just some negative constant. And one can see that V of R is monotonic. So V of R has the behavior for BTZ that it does something like this, whereas for ADS Schwarzschild, so this is D greater than or equal to 3, it's possible via the angular momentum barrier to have some stable classical region. In BTZ, this is impossible. Any particle in the BTZ metric will in some small amount of time, in less than one orbiting time, will fall into the black hole. And this is important for us because this means that the perturbative calculation that I erased in order to write this doesn't make sense anymore at all in this background. There are no classical orbits perturbed by some small black hole effect at large distances. There just aren't any classical orbits at all. There are quasi-normal modes, which are the closest analog. These are at least naively not things that you should see from the bootstrap because they're not eigenstates. They're not even good approximations to Hamiltonian or dilatation operator eigenstates. They have some finite imaginary piece just set by R plus that, again, doesn't vanish as L goes to infinity. So these are the quasi-normal modes. What's the interpretation of these quasi-normal modes? A reasonable interpretation is that above this BTZ threshold, there's just some approximate continuum of states.
The global ADS3 doesn't have orbits either?
Global ADS3 does. Good. So this is something that is slightly. So what does this look like? Well, above the BTZ threshold, mu is bigger than 1. And this, if we're just talking about BTZ, of course, this is just going away, right? So if mu is bigger than 1, this is negative as r goes to 0. But if mu is less than 1, so we're in the deficit angle or pure ADS case, this is positive as r goes to 0. And the angular momentum barrier just keeps you away. And so these are the quasi-normal modes. These really just follow from the fact that in the BTZ background, if we have some scalar field, it just has some thermal correlator. That looks like that. So what we're going to see at the end, in fact, the one of the punchlines from the bootstrap will be that this correlator in due to some BTZ black hole background, and it looks exactly thermal. What we'll see, in fact, is that the Virasoro conformal block associated with the exchange of the Virasoro identity operator between some heavy operator and a light operator phi exactly reproduces this result. So if you're an expert, that might not surprise you, but I was at least intrigued by the fact that that came out. So now I'm going to move on to the CFT side. So any questions about these ADS results? The claim I'm making is that everything that I've said about ADS, at least as a statement about the large L part of these spectra, will be reproduced from the bootstrap. So if you want to go to sleep, that's the lesson you should go to sleep. Okay. So what's the idea of how to derive this from the bootstrap? It's of course similar to the diagrams that I just erased. So if we have some CFT operator now, phi 1 is a CFT operator. And I should say this is CFT greater than or equal to 3 to start with. So this is reviewing some results from a year ago. So the idea in pictures is that we're writing the bootstrap equation, connecting this channel with this other channel. And we want to prove that these things exist, that these guys exist and have to match and have to have the properties that we like. So this, of course, by itself is a truncation of the bootstrap equation. Why am I doing that? Well, as an equation, this is some statement about so I'm writing sums of conformal block coefficients times conformal blocks. And I've just, for convenience and illustration, isolated some leading lightcone OPE piece of the conformal blocks. So the point here is that so this exchange is here, and these sorts of things are there, and these would be a subset, since I wrote down these guys, which I'm trying to prove exist, they would be a subset of what's being exchanged here. The point is that in the light cone OPE limit, so the light cone OPE limit is U goes to 0, V fixed in terms of these conformal cross ratios, there's a singularity here. And in fact, there's a singularity from all of these other terms. If so the left-hand side is singular from operators with tau less than delta 1 plus delta 2. And in particular, the strongest singularity here is from the identity. This is just free propagation, quote unquote. And the point is that the terms on the right-hand side do not have such a singularity. The strongest singularity they have is a log u as u goes to 0. This is a power law singularity. And so it can't be reproduced by any finite number of terms on the right-hand side. And there have to be an infinite number of terms. And so I won't go through the matching, but just to illustrate what Arkady was saying, this is really just the this is really just x 1, 3 to the 2 delta 1, x 2, 4 to the 2 delta 2. This is really just this specific term is just this free propagation Witt contraction that Arkady was mentioning. And I emphasize that just to make the point that if we truncate this further to we just ignore for a second this whole term, this is really just the matching that has to go on in a generalized free theory. So the u to the minus delta 1 plus delta 2 over 2 is the same as in a generalized free theory, otherwise known as free QFT in ADS D plus 1. So that's all we're matching when we match that term. And I'm not going to go through the technicalities of the matching. You'll have to trust me. But the claim is that this implies that we need operators with tau equals delta 1 plus delta 2 plus 2n. Plus some gamma. By tau, I'm referring to the twist, dimension minus spin, as L goes to infinity, for each value of this n, with gamma nL goes to 0 in that limit. And if we assume that there's one such operator per n and L, which seems reasonable but is some additional assumption, then we can show that we recover just the generalized free theory conformal block or OPE coefficients. Now, if we match the subleading terms here, we can clearly match the subleading terms in principle, since all of these are singular, all the way out to tau of delta 1 plus delta 2. But just for simplicity, so far we've only worked on this by matching the leading exchange. And the interesting point that arises is that this function here looks like log v as v goes to 0 with some coefficient. I'm being very schematic. So we'd like to reproduce some subleading singularity with a log v behavior from these sorts of terms. And we notice that one can get a log v from here if one makes an assumption like this, in particular for n equals 0. This just becomes v to the gamma and L, which is going to 0, which is, in other words, 1 plus gamma and L log V in the limit that gamma is small. So in fact, it's the anomalous dimension piece on the right-hand side, which matches these exchanges. And by performing that match precisely and using the OP coefficients of things like the stress energy tensor or conserved currents, we get some prediction for the anomalous dimension. And I could write out the formulas. It's not that interesting. The point is that in the case of, say, T mu nu, it exactly matches the calculation of ADS greater than or equal to 4 gravity. So that's this work.
So the F UV in the V goes to 0 limit, that log V, there's no power of V multiplying the log in F?
So there's a whole power series, which starts with constant plus log V, and then there's general terms with powers of V times log and powers of V without logs.
And what's the limit you took that allows you to extract the large L limit in that?
Good. So I mean, there's a lot of work here, and depending on how rigorous you want it, one can actually be very rigorous about this, but it requires a fair amount of work. You need to, so first of all, you want to show that this infinite sum reproduces this term from large L and not large twist. That's kind of obvious because large twist gives you a large power of V, and this is independent of V. So that's what nails this. So then you can get the sum from large L. Then you do some approximation to the conformal blocks at large L, which allows you to actually do the sum and make some argument. And then you can rephrase the rephrase everything in terms of the density accumulating at large L. And then by studying that density, you can show that it matches this spectrum with basically accumulation points here. Okay, so now I want to talk in the last 10 minutes.
Sorry, I'm just trying to understand how there was no, so don't you need some information about the coefficients, this P, which also depends on L? How come that didn't?
You mean these coefficients?
Yes.
Good. So the point is that you're looking at on the left-hand side here, you're looking at the contribution of the lowest twist operators. So that's important. And it's very important, in fact, about what I'm about to say. So the lowest twist operators will generically be either T mu nu and J mu, or possibly some scalar with lower twist. And so you're just matching the first few terms here. In principle, one could do this matching for all of the singular terms, and there could be a lot of operators, and that would be a lot of work. It's in principle possible, but that's what we're restricting to. So there are, of course, theories that have, as you're an expert in, that have many, many, many low twist operators, like higher spin conserved currents, and then this would be, in principle, a lot more complicated, and the story can change. And in fact, CFT2 is exactly a situation where that's an issue.
Does positivity of P play a role in this?
No, I don't think that. In this matching, I don't think that positivity of P is crucial. Depending on how rigorous you want to be, it may be important, the positivity of P. So these P's are positive. These P's aren't necessarily even positive, because, for example, I could exchange a current and I could get either sign. The positivity of these P's is, I think, kind of important in making a rigorous argument that you have to recover exactly this twist spectrum, because otherwise you could imagine cancellations that deviated from this. But unitarity is very important. So I can stress, unitarity was very important here, because note that tau is bigger than, it's bigger than or equal to 0 in all cases, so that tells me that this term dominates. In CFT greater than or equal to 3, tau is strictly bigger than 0, and so that allows me to say that this dominates over all of these terms. This is exactly the thing that fails in CFT2, which I'm about to talk about. So in CFT2, what are the differences? Well, one is, there are One is just what I said, that there are tau equals zero ops besides strictly the operator one. In particular, there's T mu nu and multi-graviton states. And of course, this is very closely related to the fact that there's an entire Virasoro algebra of symmetry. So the existence of... Good. So there can be T mu nu, there could also be some J mu. I'm going to assume for the rest of this talk that's not there. I think it would be very interesting to generalize what I'm about to say to the case of there being a current, but I'll only talk about CFTs. So I'll be talking about, in particular, I'll be doing CFT at large central charge for reasons that I'll tell you in a second. But I'll be studying CFTs at large central charge where the only twist zero operator besides the identity are the full Virasoro identity conformal block. And so the reason to study CFTs at large C isn't because I particularly want to or I think that these results won't generalize in some way to order 1C as long as it's bigger than 1, but because we need to compute the entire Virasoro identity block, including all of these terms contributing here. So we need the full Virasoro identity block. And there are various techniques in the literature for computing Virasoro conformal blocks, including the identity, but none of them give some exact formula. There are techniques that give you a series expansion that are very good, but unfortunately, we need to study the light cone OPE limit, which translates to z goes to 1, and say with z bar goes to 0. And if we want to be able to study that limit, then we can't use a series expansion around z equals 0. And so we used two techniques in our upcoming paper. One was brute force, which is very, very transparent if you've never dealt with 2D conformal field theories, but it's more limited in scope. And so instead, I'll talk about, I don't have time to talk about the method, but talk about the more general result that overlaps, derived by this monodromy method, where one cleverly inserts a light operator into one's correlators. And if one assumes that light operator obeys a shortening condition, one can derive a differential equation to solve for the Virasoro conformal block. So we'll need to study the limit, the semi-classical limit . So in other words, we're taking the large C limit where one of the operators has a dimension that can be bigger than or smaller than C and is of order C, and the other operator is light. And so we're going to, effectively, we're expanding in 1 over C and H1 over C with H2 over C finite. And this naturally matches with the ADS story that I was telling you about before, because this will be our either deficit angle or black hole, and this will be some light probe that's orbiting it. So the result for the holomorphic conformal block can be written in that way, where f of z looks like h1 over c, and alpha is just root 1 minus 24, or in other words, what you would call 1 minus 8 gm. So the result of some few-page computation using this method, gives you this conformal block, and one can rewrite, well, I've already said that, but what does this look like when translated into this language for uniformity? In the u goes to zero limit, this looks like it looks like this. And so we still have a singularity as u goes to zero, which is what we expected because all of these twist zero things that we're adding up here. So, I mean, one can think about this as the exchange between phi one and phi two of something one would think of as like, well, in ADS3, they would be multi-graviton states. In the CFT, these are the exchange of all the Virasoro descendants of the identity. So that's what's going in here to make this up. But we have this much more exotic V dependence of the conformal block. And if one uses this function now instead of constant, well, instead of a constant here, this is the identity block in higher dimensional CFTs, one finds a spectrum of twists.
Sorry, what's capital V on the left-hand side? What's the?
Oh, this is supposed to be f of z bar written in terms of u and v. So this is just the identity block.
Wait, but where's the single charge? Shouldn't it be raised to some power c? You know?
So the central charge is canceled from this. It only appears in alpha by in this way. So if one performs the same matching, one finds that there's a spectrum that looks like this, which is exactly so here I'm assuming that alpha is real, so we're below the BTZ threshold. One finds a spectrum that looks like this. And this matches the spectrum for a scalar field in a deficit angle background in ADS3. And it so this is the spectrum of twists. And one also notices that the spacing of the different modes labeled by n is becoming smaller and smaller as we approach the BTZ threshold. So now what about alpha imaginary, where HEM is bigger than 1? So
where's the little L dependence?
Oh, good. So there's no little L dependence here on the twist. So the claim is that one has some accumulation point at large L of exactly this twist. And what you're asking about would be something like a gamma NL. And this will be present for sure in general, but we can't compute it because one would need contributions like this. So basically, we're matching just the identity part, which is just Virasoro. These higher corrections would give you a gamma.
If I imagine the CFT has, say, all the primaries are scalars, would you run into any problem, or is that consistent?
No, that's consistent. So then you would just be talking about phi 1 and phi 2 or just external scalars, and that's fine. I mean, there would be, I think that this tells you that you're forced to have primaries with higher spin at large spin in the OP of those scalars.
What tells you that you have the... have to have
primary
large spin
in LB? It's the matching of this equation. So I'm replacing this with this function. And there's some analysis which I haven't even told you about. So first of all, if we just we can choose to just talk about things in terms of global conformal blocks on the right-hand side if we want. And that this singularity being replaced with this still tells you that you need an infinite number of them. And one can show that the Virasoro conformal blocks on the right-hand side using the Monodry method in a similar approximation, certainly any finite number of them isn't enough to make up this singularity either. And so you need an infinite number. So this is something no one has asked about yet until you just did. But the claim that I'm making is that there are an infinite number of Virasoro primaries at large L, not just global primaries. There are some subtleties about these spacings if one talks about global versus Virasoro. In particular, it's hard to rule out. One could imagine a situation where there's some other integer m here, and there are spacings that are spaced by alpha according to this integer, and spacings that are just extra integer spacings. And for technical reasons, this is hard to rule out. But
do you want this to be true for any theory, any irrational theory with c larger than 1, or is this just a large c?
So I believe it's probably true for any irrational theory with c larger than 1, but I don't think that we have a proof.
But isn't the assumption about the Jacob spectrum because there only something over lateral dependence?
The only assumption is that I'm looking at CFT2 at large C, and the only twist zero operators are the identity and the Virasoro descendants of the identity. So I'm assuming there's no currents. That could change the story considerably. But the fact there being some primary of a dimension one, a twist one half or something, wouldn't be a problem. It would just enter into these terms, and it would produce some sort of anomalous dimension out here, one would imagine.
Is it possible for just in terms of, you know, you're talking about the gravity dual, right? But because you have this independent tool, because I'm not sure that generically it could be that there is no in dual, right? So in this way, can I take it that you are proving the existence of this dual?
I don't know what, it depends on what your definition of a dual is. This is kind of a philosophical question. My personal perspective is that, and I mean, for example, for simplicity, we can just take the higher dimensional case.
Yeah.
What we've proven is that that one can interpret the spectrum of any CFT as states moving around in ADS that become free at large at something that you would call large distances.
Okay.
So the 3D icing model has this property. Whether or not that dual has an explicit nice string quantum field theory or string theory description or anything, I'm not making any claim like that. But if one just views space-time as something that you work out for yourself based on what the spectrum of your quantum theory looks like, which I think is a fair way of thinking about space-time, then sure, you can say that there's a dual. One thing I'm definitely not saying is that the dual would be local at distances that are comparable or shorter than the ADS length. That's absolutely not true. I'm only saying that interactions fall off at very large distances in this particular way. So I guess I'm out of time. This way of writing the identity conformal block, I can rewrite this as so beta is sort of this, maybe I'll just call this I alpha. In fact, we'll just call it alpha. I can rewrite this as a statement like this. In the case where, so here this is just, I'm just taking each GM to be bigger than 1. It's the same answer, and I'll continue there.
What quantity is
that? This is this V. I'm writing it a little bit schematically now. The point that I want to make is that this looks like, I'm just restating a point I made before. I can rearrange this so that it looks like this. And in other words, it looks like some phi one correlator in some thermal background with a temperature set by the BTZ black hole. So in particular, by various different methods, one can either from this conformal block and the thermal correlator that it equals extract the quasi-normal modes that I talked about for the BTZ black hole. Or if one explicitly puts this into the bootstrap analysis, the bootstrap only knows about stable states, not about states with an imaginary energy. And so one shows that there have to be a continuum of twists at large spin. So that's the conclusion in the BTZ case. It matches what one expects from the ADS3 background. And in particular, there's some continuum of twists at large spin.
What's the relation to U, V, and Z?
So it's just, so in, it's just the usual. So here this involves the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic piece. There's a left moving and a right moving temperature associated with R plus and R minus in some general spinning BTZ. So this is really, I think, the punchline, is that simply by computing using this monodromy method, the Virasoro conformal block at large central charge, one shows that every primary phi two is just a completely general primary with dimension above the BTZ bound, looks like it produces a black hole. And so in conclusion, this means that in principle, computing subleading corrections to this Virasoro conformal block, one would be computing subleading corrections that the CFT knows about to the thermality of this BTZ state. And so there are obvious further directions, including currents, and also if one can use more sophisticated methods to compute these Virasoro conformal blocks, one could really say something perhaps about thermality. If one includes subleading corrections like this associated with anomalous dimensions, one might hope to say something about the regime of validity of these results. So in other words, can you show that black holes don't have any hair? Because when you get close to the, because basically these results are true down to very small L. So things like that would be interesting to address, even recent proposals that perhaps the black hole horizon has some non-locality associated with it or some strange physics associated with it. In principle, one could hope to say something about the states near the black hole and thereby rule out or discover such proposals. So that's it.
In this last part?
Yeah.
Get the quasi-normal modes, right?
Yeah.
That involves Fourier transforming the two-point function that you've written there.
Exactly.
So you're saying that two-point function is valid at all z?
Oh, good. So
Fourier transform if you only know the behavior at coincident points.
Good. So here, I mean, I think what we're finding here is simply the exchange of the Virasoro identity block gives you the entire spectrum of phi in this BTZ background. Now, what you're pointing out is that I shouldn't trust that because there can be corrections to it due to other stuff. And so you're totally right, and that's certainly true. But
we should trust it in some limit of z, but it's trusting it for all z that I'm worried about.
So the computation of this is true for all z in the monodromy method.
Block, but not as a formula for the two-point function. I assume it's only in some way.
It's. I, As a formula, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, do you mean that there are corrections due to other effects besides the identity block, or do you just mean the identity block itself is not a good, doesn't behave well in Z? Because I think the identity block is fine for any value of Z. So here, what I've...
I'm worried about the other corrections as you move away from Z equals 1, that there are corrections from other fields, contributions from other fields.
Yeah, so that's true when... yes, that would be true when you move away from 1, because here we're that would be like these other kinds of contributions from higher twist things. But I mean, I think the fact that it matches the quasi-normal modes is the statement that when you assume that you're solving for a scalar field in a BTZ background, you're just assuming that the only effect is gravity. And once you make that assumption, you get the quasi-normal modes in that background. Here, computing using the Virasoro identity and nothing else is exactly the same as assuming there's just a classical gravity background in ADS and you're quantizing some scalar field in that background. So
I guess my question though is whether you've derived the quasi-normal modes from CFT.
I've derived the quasi-normal modes from CFT in a limit where the only low dimension primaries are phi and that's it, right?
In a limit or in a theory?
So, I mean, if the only primary is contributing here is if the only primary contributing is the identity, up to say black holes. So the only primaries in this theory are phi and black holes. Then I think that we've derived it in any such theory. But in other theories, the black hole can interact with phi in some complicated way.
In your block, you assumed H1 was large?
I'm assuming, good, yeah. So that's probably not, I don't think that's strictly necessary.
Can you relax that assumption and
go back to this formula? So the Menagerie, good. So the Menagerie method is an expansion at H1 over C. So my Menagerie method, my semi-classical limit, let's call it the semi-classical probe limit, is H1 over C small, and H2 over C just fixed, and C goes to infinity.
Was H1 over C much bigger than 1 over C?
H1 was assumed to begin with to be much bigger than 1. I don't think there are 1 over H1 corrections, but maybe I'm wrong. Tom, do you have an opinion about this? Basically, one is doing expansion, just this is small. I don't think that this being bigger than one is necessary. For example, in order to compute the Virasoro identity block, one can instead compute blocks involving the exchange of some primary other than the identity and expand in that dimension. And in fact, the identity block is just the limit as that dimension vanishes. So I think that there are not corrections in 1 over H1, but I'm not absolutely certain.
So I didn't understand the statement you made earlier about assuming only the identity, that's the only life that I contribute on the left-hand side, because don't you expect to have weakly bound two particle states, say?
Yeah, so you're certainly right that in some theory where there is a single primary that's much lighter than M Planck, much lighter than C, that you would then expect there to be other primaries corresponding to multi-particle states. And yes, in principle, those can contribute there. I think we don't usually worry about multi-particle states contaminating the quantization of a single particle around a black hole. But yes, those would, in general, probably appear there.
And in practice, the only other than that, you need the large C to write the explicit formula. What do you actually need to make statement about the component I mentioned in these limits? Do you just need the Z equal to 1 limit, or?
Yeah, one just needs the light cone OP limit of the Virasoro block. That's it. So, if there's some better way of computing that would be great.